From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a way to help you understand the point Radley Balco is getting at in his book about the militarization of the country's police forces. In the 1970s, police SWAT teams were a relatively new phenomenon, and there were maybe a few hundred SWAT team actions every year. Now, skip ahead to 2005, where there were 50,000 of these deployments in the United States. Balco's book really explores how we got here, from a country where we were intent on keeping soldiers out of law enforcement to a place where there's a dominant military culture in modern police agencies. Balco says his book is not anti-cop, but you could say it's anti-politician. He says the rise of the warrior cop has come from decades of bad policies by bad politicians. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. In his book about the militarization of America's police forces, the investigative reporter Radley Balco says, if you want to get a sense of the way military culture has taken over modern police agencies, just go to one of the many SWAT team conferences held every year. He says you can find vendors there who know their market, and they're selling the same kinds of products to local police agencies as the national military folks. We're talking about flash grenades and pepper spray and gear for riot teams. Even the language you hear on modern police forces, the lingo, is what you would hear from a soldier. But Balco argues there's supposed to be a difference between a cop and a soldier. His book explores how we got here, from a country suspicious about the military being involved in domestic affairs to a place where SWAT teams around the country now violently smash into private homes more than 100 times per day. The book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop, and Radley Balco is joining us today to talk about it. Radley Balco is a senior writer and investigative reporter for The Huffington Post. Before that, he was a senior editor at Reason magazine and a policy analyst for the libertarian think tank the Cato Institute. Joining us today, though, from a studio in Nashville, Tennessee, Radley Balco, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I wanted to get this out of the way because you do fairly early on make this clear. You say early in the book, it's not an anti-cop book. In fact, you say it could maybe more accurately be described as an anti-politician book. Explain what you mean, because I want to sort of get this out of the way so we can move on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly the book does talk about some rogue cops and some pretty terrible incidents involving bad cops. But, I don't really think it does a lot of good for people to rail against the police and, you know, use terminology like pigs and so forth. I think we got to where we are today because of bad policy and bad incentives. And, you know, you can take really great people and feed them into a system full of bad policy and bad incentives, and you're going to continue to get bad results. So the focus of the book, I try to focus most of it on policy and on the politicians that supported the policies that, you know, have gotten us to the point where we are today.
Mm. You say in the book that this gradual transformation over 35 years or so hasn't exactly been secretive. It's, you know, been unfolding pretty gradually. But you're right that we don't seem to have noticed. What do you mean?
I think we do sort of notice, but we don't. When something happens gradually over a long period of time, we tend to acclimate to it as it's happening.
Yeah.
And I think that's really what's happened with these SWAT raids. And, you know, in the introduction, I talk in the book about a video a couple of years ago that went viral about the video was of a SWAT raid, a drug raid in Columbia, Missouri. And, you know, it was a very standard raid. There was nothing unusual about it. This was not a botched raid. These weren't rogue cops. This was, you know, similar to the 100 or so of these raids that happen every day in America. But people were terrified and really angry at the images that they saw in that video. And, it was a SWAT team in Columbia taking down the door of this house with a battering ram, shooting and killing one of the dogs, mistakenly shooting the other dog. There was a child in the house that they weren't aware of. And it was, you know, it was an extraordinarily violent, confrontational, volatile sort of situation. And this was over pot. It was over an anonymous tip that police had gotten that there was some drug activity in the home. They looked to the family's trash and found some traces of pot. And that's really what that was the evidence for this raid. And they ended up finding a small amount of pot. But ironically, marijuana has been decriminalized in Colombia. So it wasn't even enough to charge the guy with a crime. And so, you know, when the video went viral and the Colombia Police Department got angry emails and phone calls and even death threats, it went, you know, sort of all over the world. You know, I found it both interesting and sort of encouraging because it was almost as if, you know, a new generation, the internet generation, for the first time was seeing how the drug war is actually fought on the ground and how, you know, how these raids are really done. And they were angry by what they saw. Yeah. And so I think, you know, I think we see the SWAT reality shows and, you know, we see SWAT teams on TV and I don't think, you know, I think we're comfortable with it. I don't think most people realize just how violent these raids are, you know, just how low level the crimes that these raids are being used to enforce. And I think when people are confronted with that and when they are made aware of it, I think there's, you know, a lot of outrage, but it's because it's been happening sort of right in front of us and slowly over a long period of time. It's, you know, it's something that I think people have to be kind of hit in the face with all over again. Mm.
What's the essential difference between a police officer and a soldier?
Well, I mean, the military's job is to annihilate a foreign enemy. I gave a talk at West Point a few years ago, and in introducing me, the professor there said the military's job is to kill people and break things. A police officer's job is to keep the peace, to protect our constitutional rights. These are two very, very different missions. And when we start to conflate the two and we start to blur the line between the two, you get into a lot of trouble. In the book, I point out that, you know, I think we've done a good job in this country, in America, about preserving this very defined line between police and military. And there have been a few exceptions throughout history, and I think a couple of them were justified. But for the most part, you know, we have resisted the urge that a lot of societies and civilizations before us have submitted to, which is this kind of culture of militarism taking over or having the military take over. What we haven't done a very good job of, and what the book is really about, is what you might call indirect militarization, right, which is, you know, while we've done a great job keeping soldiers from domestic law enforcement, we've allowed and really encouraged our police officers to become more like soldiers. And, you know, when it comes to how they approach the job and how they see the people that they interact with, the citizens that they interact with on a day-to-day basis, you know, if they see themselves as soldiers fighting a war, the outcome is going to be very similar than it would be if they actually were soldiers.
I want to back up for a minute and talk a little bit about history because it's an important part of understanding this bigger story, and you spend some time with it in the book. Let's talk about ancient Rome. This is the world's first organized police force you talk about, and it's interesting how sensitive you say the Roman public was to this threat of militarization. You know, as we now know the term crossing the Rubicon, but, you know, soldiers in Rome for a time, they were forbidden to enter the capital as soldiers.
That's right. And when Caesar crossed the Rubicon with his army, that was that's where we get that saying, which is this point of no return, because he had now violated the Roman Republic's prohibition on soldiers, you know, entering the city as soldiers. And the Rubicon was sort of the outer boundary of Rome at the time. But after the Republic falls and we get the, Imperial Rome, the first emperor Octavian sets up this first organized kind of centralized police force, which he makes up of his the bodyguards that he had used during the Civil War, the Praetorian cohorts. And he calls it the Praetorian Guard, and he sets up this centralized police force. And, you know, their job is basically to keep security, mostly to protect the emperor and, you know, his family. But their duties begin to grow to the point of investigating, you know, espionage, of keeping, you know, security during the Colosseum games, and even things like fighting fires and trying to prevent riots. But as you mentioned, you know, even in Imperial Rome, with this very first organized centralized police agency, I guess, for lack of a better term, police force, I guess is a better way to put it. He was very cognizant of this historical kind of Roman aversion to standing armies. And so, you know, he positioned a couple of armies in the city, but most of them he positioned outside the city. They were close enough where they could come, you know, to his aid if he needed it. But the most of the legions he puts outside the city. The ones inside the city he makes wear togas, not the traditional military garb. Again, understanding that just the sight of soldiers sort of patrolling the city was likely to upset the citizenry and also, you know, upset his political opponents. You know, he was very sensitive to the fact that he was, you know, beginning an emperorship and did not want to look like a tyrant.
You know, you write about, for example, Great Britain in its very earliest days. They, you know, they use an English system that follows common law, not Roman law. And common law, I take it, was about resolving disputes rather than enforcing, you know, the will of a king or of an emperor. And this is a kind of an important theme, it seems like, in understanding all of this.
Yeah, I mean, Britain was isolated, obviously being an island. You know, continental Europe was subject to constant, you know, mutinies and revolutions, and Britain was quite a bit more stable. And so the emphasis on, you know, keeping order in Britain kind of evolved around this idea of protecting rights and just keeping the peace as opposed to keeping the emperor or king in power. And so what we see in Britain is this evolution of common law. And this idea that the purpose of the law should be to try to peacefully resolve disputes between people. And, you know, in Britain, you could even sue a member of the king's guard or the army who had violated your rights, which was unheard of in the rest of Europe. A couple of other interesting things about, you know, early British law is that it was done basically within communities. Right. Communities were divided into these sections called shires, and you know the person who represented the king's interest or reported to the king in the shire was a representative who lived in the shire and was part of the shire. And so there was this you know the incentive was and also if somebody broke serious laws and was not held accountable by the shire itself, the king held the entire shire accountable.
Yeah.
So there was this nice balance of accountability and civil liberties, and this little bit of trivia, I guess. The person appointed to kind of represent the shire was called the reeve, which came on the two words were merged into shire reeve, which is the origin of our word sheriff, which is sort of the same thing, right? As a person who represents a certain geographical area and represents a law enforcement interest in that area. But we see this throughout Britain until it starts to urbanize in the mid to late 19th century. But this kind of, you know, using common law and social shunning and mores and really kind of community private policing is really – and it's effective. I mean, it's a good way to keep order and protect rights.
So there's this question you ask in the book really early on. Are cops constitutional? Which sort of gets us to the colonial period. And it's a question you admit seems odd. I mean, given there has never really been a constitutional challenge to the general authority of the police, but it's a question that comes from this legal scholar you mentioned, Roger Rootes, who you describe as this fairly radical libertarian, who says, in fact, that police forces that we've grown accustomed to today in the United States are not really accounted for in the U.S. Constitution. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, so at the time of the founding, you know, we inherited a lot of that British tradition. So, you know, order was kept within communities by shunning and social pressure and social stigmas. And so there wasn't really any need for any kind of central organized law enforcement. We had some, you know, sheriffs and marshals and constables, but their duties were largely administrative, things like, you know, serving subpoenas or collecting taxes. We didn't really have imprisonment as punishment per se. We had jails, but they were basically to hold people over until trial. You know, at trial, you were usually ordered to pay some sort of compensation, or in very serious cases, you know, you would be killed because the death penalty was pretty common then. But, you know, we didn't really need centralized, organized policing. And so, you know, when the founders wrote the Constitution, they could not have anticipated police as they exist today, or even as they existed, you know, when they first started in the 19th century. And in fact, so Roots basically makes the argument that because they couldn't have anticipated it, there's plenty of historical evidence that what the founders did fear was the standing army and the violations of civil liberties that come with a standing army. And they, you know, they were students of history. They knew about Rome. They knew about continental Europe. And they were fearful of this, idea of an army enforcing the law domestically. And they were also had their own experience with this problem in Boston when the British Crown stationed troops in the streets of Boston to enforce the tax and import laws. And this led to a lot of, you know, violent confrontations between British soldiers and Bostonians, of course, ultimately culminating in the Boston Massacre, which, you know, was probably the first shots of the American Revolution. So the idea is that the founders, you know, would not have recognized police, that they had this fear of standing army, and they would have viewed police, even the early police departments, but, you know, certainly the SWAT teams and heavily militarized police we see today, as the very sort of standing army that they feared.
There's a concept. The founders were, of course, powerfully influenced by a lot of these Enlightenment principles. And there's a concept you write about that really was influential. It's called the Castle Doctrine, which you describe as this crucial concept that in some ways kind of lost much of its meaning today. Explain the Castle Doctrine.
Right. So today the Castle Doctrine is – you usually hear it in the context of the gun control debate and, you know, this idea that you should be able to shoot someone who's breaking into your home and isn't legally authorized to be there. But it stems from this much older tradition, in fact, that goes back to ancient Rome and even ancient Greece. And it's this idea that the home should be a place of peace and sanctuary, that, you know, it's your place of refuge with your family, and that – it should be free of violence and you know, government intervention. And so the Castle Doctrine has a long tradition in English common law. That tradition carried over into the colonies and into the founding of the United States. And it was this very kind of sacred idea that you should, you know, you should not have to worry about the government breaking into your home with, you know, unless you were a danger or a threat to someone else, and under the most extreme, you know, circumstances when no other options were available. And even then, under British common law, the king's men were required to knock, announce themselves and announce their purpose and give you the opportunity to come to the door and let them in peacefully to avoid violence to you and your family and to, you know, the destruction of your property, you know, namely your front door.
Right.
And so this was a very highly valued, highly cherished principle in both Britain and in, you know, colonial and sort of the founding era of the United States.
We're going to sort of break down how it breaks down, this idea, as it evolves. Let me ask you, one of the things that you write about is, and this is something that sort of gets us back to Roger Roots, because he has this argument that gets at this idea that there's been this balance of power, or there should be anyway, this balance of power between the average American citizen and the state. And that what you've seen now in this, you know, with the advent of modern policing, the militarization of police forces around the country, that this balance has been thrown off, that we're kind of askew. And this is where we get to the idea of it being unconstitutional. But I wanted you to say something about that balance of power. There's supposed to be some kind of equilibrium going on, I guess.
Well, yeah, there should be. And what Roots talks about is that, you know, because law enforcement was largely, you know, a private affair in colonial times, you know, you didn't there was a balance. You know, if you wanted to bring criminal charges against someone, you basically acted as prosecutor. Full-time prosecutors didn't exist either. And so you would basically bring your charges to a grand jury, and it would be up to you to prosecute your case against this other person. What Roots talks about is, you know, when we start to move to a system where you have a federal law enforcement, you know, or excuse me, law enforcement working for the government, and then you have prosecutors working for the government, you know, they can now marshal all the government's resources to go after you if they want to go after you. And so you start to see an upset in this balance. And, you know, it gets to the point where, you know, for at least until the Gideon versus Wainwright decision from the Supreme Court, you know, the state wasn't even obligated to provide you with an attorney. So they, you know, they could bring these charges against you. They could marshal, you know, the police force and, you know, the entire police department was basically at their disposal, and you as a citizen basically had no real way to defend yourself or fight back. And Roots, you know, sort of traces this evolution of policing and law enforcement in America as a, you know, kind of a real sort of turning upside down of the values and the general kind of principles and the general relationship between the individual and the state that the country was founded upon.
Radley Balko is with us. He's the author of the book Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the investigative journalist Radley Balko. He's written a book that chronicles what he calls the militarization of the country's police forces. Balko says for decades, Americans worked to keep the military out of law enforcement. But over the years, we're seeing more and more aggressive raids, SWAT teams, armored vehicles. Even the terms we use in policing, he says, are taken from the ideas of war. So, Radley Balko, you say the real beginning of the story of the modern police militarization kind of comes with the social upheaval and the civil unrest in the 1960s. This is a really crucial time for this transition. What's going on there that makes this a time of change?
There are really two trends that start in the late 60s that I think played a key role in getting us here. The first is the rise of the SWAT team. And we could trace the SWAT team origin. Of course, there have been similar teams throughout, you know, history, policing history, both in the U.S. and across the world. But the kind of the modern SWAT team goes back to, its inception was in 1965 when the Watts riots were going on in Los Angeles. And there was an inspector within the Los Angeles Police Department named Daryl Gates, name we're probably a lot of people familiar with. He went on to become police chief, a very controversial police chief. But Gates was really upset by what happened during the riots. He was in charge of the department's response, and he didn't feel that the department really had an adequate response to that kind of civil uprising. It reminded him a lot of, urban guerrilla warfare, and he thought that, there was a time in American history where, you could reasonably anticipate there was going to be more of that kind of unrest. And so he thought that, he had to come up with some way that the police department could use, overwhelming military-like response to put down these kinds of uprisings in order to save lives. And so he worked with some Marines at Camp Pendleton nearby and came up with this idea of this elite, highly trained, highly specialized police unit that would be able to respond very, very quickly, both to riots but also to active shooter situations and, bank robberies and hostage takings. Emergency type situations and basically use overwhelming force and violence to defuse the situation as quickly as possible. And he came up with the moniker SWAT, which originally he had come up with to stand for special weapons assault teams. Someone at the LAPD said assault probably shouldn't be in the title, so he changed it to special weapons and tactics. And basically the SWAT team was born. The first SWAT raid, well, actually, let me back up a little bit. One interesting little fact is Gates first brought this idea to Chief William Parker shortly after the Watts riots, and Parker actually shot him down. He said that this idea of a kind of a paramilitary police team tread too close to this traditional line of separation that we have in America between police and soldiers. And so he actually told Gates that he wasn't permitted to go on with the idea. Gates did anyway, sort of surreptitiously. And when the new when Parker died and Chief Redden took over, which I believe was in 1967 or 68, Gates got the green light to go ahead with the idea. The first SWAT raid in America was in 1969 on a Black Panther holdout in Los Angeles. It was televised across the state of California. And, logistically it was kind of a disaster, but, it ended with no deaths on either side, actually. And, it was this kind of heroic police team that was confronting a group that a lot of America feared. The Black Panthers at the time were a violent organization. There was a long trail of bodies of both Panthers and police officers leading up to that raid. And you know, the next raid comes in 1973 against the Symbionese Liberation Army, or I guess the next high-profile raid. Mm-hmm. You know, and in that case, the country was following this SLA, this domestic terrorist group, because they had kidnapped Patty Hearst, the mm-hmm. newspaper heiress. And so this was kind of a, you know, the tabloid crime story of the time. The whole country was watching this case. And so when the LAPD and the FBI thought that they had isolated this group at a house in L.A., there were national news reporters on the scene. And so when the raid actually goes down, you have news cameras rolling and it's televised across the country. And in fact, you can still find videos on YouTube of reporters sort of ducking under cars as bullets are whizzing by. And, you know, this raid really injects SWAT into the pop culture and becomes a phenomenon. The next 1975, Aaron Spelling produces a melodrama called SWAT that's right. on national TV.
Yeah.
You know, you get SWAT lunchboxes and a Milton Bradley SWAT board game. And so, you know, in 1970, we had one SWAT team in this country. And by 1975, we had about 500. Basically, every significant size city in the country has its own SWAT team.
So you talk about, somewhat significant-sized cities are having these SWAT teams. But there's another phenomenon you write about that goes on, it seems like in the 80s, how even police operations in relatively small communities create their own SWAT teams. You mentioned Logan, Utah is one of these typical examples. I mean, it's a city of 50,000 people, hasn't had a murder in 6 or 7 years. It's been rated as the safest city in America in certain times, you mentioned. But it has a SWAT team.
Right. And in the book, I talk about the article that talks about the Logan SWAT team and the interview with, either the sheriff or the police chief there, who said, yeah, you know, we don't have murders. We don't have, you know, barricades or active shooter situations. So, you know, we want to use the SWAT team, so we use them on drug raids.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, that we've probably taken down a lot of doors that probably wouldn't have needed to be taken down otherwise. But, you know, you've got – I'm paraphrasing now. But,
sure.
you know, you've got the SWAT team and you want to use it. And this is, you know, this is what we see this happening all across the country in the 80s. If I can back up just a little bit to the 70s, the other trend that's going on at the same time as the rise of the SWAT team is the federal drug war.
Yeah.
And Nixon declares war on drugs in, I think, 72-ish. And one of the policies that he passes is the no-knock raid.
Right.
And what's fascinating about the no-knock raid is that it's not something that police chiefs were clamoring for. It's not something that criminologists were saying was necessary. It's actually the brainchild of a 28-year-old Senate staffer who thought Nixon needed an issue, mm-hmm. kind of a wedge issue, you know, to make him appealing to middle-class, basically white America who was afraid of urban crime. And so this idea that this no-knock raid that's basically been with us ever since and is ubiquitous today, I think it's fascinating that its origin was basically as a political tool, not as a policing tool that, you know, police departments and police officials were saying was necessary.
Yeah. Important because this is something you write in the book. You say this is really this point here, this Nixon sort of political dimension is when we really began to see, as you put it in the book, this link between drugs, crime, the counterculture and race.
Right. And this becomes – yeah, it becomes – the drug war becomes part of the culture wars during the Nixon administration. And so these two trends sort of take off, the SWAT teams and the drug war. But they're moving parallel to one another for the most part throughout the 1970s. The SWAT teams are still – you know, they're growing. They're expanding across the country, but they're still reserved for these emergency-type situations where you're using violence to defuse an already violent situation where you're trying to save lives. The drug war is continuing, but you've got these federal agents that are kicking down doors and raiding places without warrants. But they're, you know, they're agents in street clothes for the most part. And the really fascinating thing about that is that, you know, even after once they do start raiding the wrong places and really kind of get out of control, Congress holds hearings. The victims of these raids come forward and testify. There are media investigations. There are political investigations. And Congress actually repeals the no-knock raid laws. They actually show a little bit of shame and remorse and show they're capable of reflection. And, you know, there was even in the height of Nixon's drug war, it was possible for Congress to say, you know, maybe we went a little too far here. And it's such a contrast to today because, I mean, I people send me these raids all the time and, you know, there are a couple a week where they get the wrong house and, you know, there's no federal political official who really cares at all. I mean, it's just sort of an accepted fact of life at this point. So we see these two trends, though. The drug war continues, the SWAT raids continue, or the spread of SWAT continues. And it's really during the Reagan administration that the two converge. And we start to see SWAT being used as part of routine drug policing, not anymore as a response to an emergency situation where you're trying to save lives and where the person you're apprehending, you know, is in the process of committing a crime. We start to see the primary use of SWAT in the 1980s until today, really, is now as an investigative tool. Right. Now SWAT teams are being used to serve search warrants, they're breaking into homes, and they're actually creating violence and confrontation where there was none before. And this is a really key moment, I think, in this story where we become comfortable with this. And it's, you know, it comes from the rhetoric of politicians. You know, they're dehumanizing drug offenders. These are an enemy to be destroyed. We start to see them as the enemy, and it makes the public okay and comfortable with this idea of letting cops, break down doors, violate the Castle Doctrine. Really, you know, it goes against the spirit of the Castle Doctrine, the spirit of even the Third Amendment, and this, you know, this posse comitatus, this idea of keeping cops and military separate. Reagan, you know, brings in the National Guard to start fighting the drug war. Reagan and some members of Congress from both parties actually wanted to bring active duty military troops and to start patrolling the streets and making drug arrests and conducting drug raids. That was one of the few bad ideas that didn't actually get made into law. But he does really kind of blur this line. He starts to make surplus military equipment to police departments across the country. He encourages cooperation between military and domestic police agencies. And he also starts these anti-drug grants, these federal drug grants that are tied just to drug policing. If you're a police chief in a place like Logan, Utah, you get this equipment from the Pentagon. This, you know, maybe it's an armored personnel carrier, some guns, some bayonets, maybe a tank. You use it to start a SWAT team. And now you can keep your SWAT team in reserve and wait for one of those emergency type situations. Or you can start sending your SWAT team out on drug raids, and that comes with federal money, these federal grants, along with other revenue-generating policies like civil asset forfeiture. Mm-hmm. And now your SWAT team can actually generate money for your police department. And it's really these incentives. This is what really drives the explosion of SWAT teams, both the number of SWAT teams and the frequency of their use.
What are we talking about in terms of frequency of use? You write about in the 1970s, there are a few hundred of these kinds of deployments in the country. I think the figure you put from 2005 is something like 50,000 of these deployments a year. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary.
Right. And this is a massive, massive increase that we see. And the 50,000 figure is actually an estimate from a criminologist named Peter Kraska at the University of Eastern Kentucky, who did some surveys in the late 90s and then did a follow-up survey in 2005. And we really don't know where we are now. I think it's safe to say that we're probably a lot higher than that because, you know, the trends that drove the initial increase have all, you know, they haven't gone anywhere. In fact, in most cases, the incentives have only gotten stronger. We see this. I mean, you know, we're talking about a 1,500% increase since the early 1980s in the use of SWAT teams. And the vast, vast majority of these deployments, again, are to serve warrants on people suspected of consensual nonviolent crimes, basically drug crimes. Just to give you another statistic that still kind of floors me when I think about it, in the early 1980s, you look at cities between – or towns, I guess, between 25,000 and 50,000 people – about 13% of them had a SWAT team in the early 80s. And by the 2000s, it was 80%.
Wow.
So basically 80% of towns with 25,000 to 50,000 people have their own SWAT team. And above 50,000, it's darn near 100% at this point. And I've also found, you know, towns as 700, 800, 1,100, 1,500 people that have SWAT teams as well.
Radley Balko is with us. His book is called Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with investigative journalist Radley Balko. We're talking about his book, Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. Let's take a call from Mick, who's with us in Draper, Utah. Mick, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
Thank you. Many people who have a police citizen encounter suffer from mental disability. I'm wondering if you've thought about the impact of militarization on mentally disabled persons.
Yeah, I think this is a growing concern, actually. There was a story that's pretty big on the East Coast right now about a man with Down syndrome who was refusing to leave a theater, and the police response was pretty overwhelming, and he ended up dying. They suffocated him. I've also seen a lot of stories about people who are having, I don't know what the correct medical term is, but basically they're diabetics who are in some sort of shock. And you can the scent, I guess, that can be given off during that condition has a vaguely kind of alcohol smell. And there have been a number of incidents where people have been, you know, tased or beaten because police mistook a diabetic situation for someone who was intoxicated. And I think, I mean, you know, the mistakes are mistakes. And, of course, you can't write off or you can't pretend that one mistake by one officer is indicative of a larger problem. Mm-hmm. But what I do think is common and something that we need to think about is that there's just not enough training in this on these particular issues. And it's similar to I write a lot about police killing dogs. And, you know, it's not necessarily that all cops are killing dogs. It's not even that, you know, maybe a significant percentage of them are. It's that when one does and, you know, even when we have video that it clearly wasn't justified, all the officer has to say is that, you know, I feared for my safety and the shooting is deemed justified. And the problem with that is so few police departments give their officers training on how to deal with dogs, how to read their body language, you know, and how to appease an angry dog. And so it's not, you know, it's not the incidents themselves, I think, that are the problem, although obviously they're very tragic when they do happen. I think the indication that there's a larger problem here is that there just isn't any, you know, training when these incidents happen.
Hmm. I want to ask you, and Mick, thanks very much for the call, by the way. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. So over the last few years, seems to be a pretty significant drop in crime statistics throughout the country. And I'm wondering how you explain that, because, of course, you're hearing some saying these more aggressive tactics are having a positive effect on crime.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to understand that the vast majority, again, of these raids, of these SWAT teams, are for drug crimes. And, you know, the drug supply hasn't gone anywhere. It's illicit drugs are as abundant as they've ever been. And the use rate of drug use hasn't really changed all that much. I think it may have gone down a few percentage points. But the drop in crime, both property crime and violent crime, has been dramatic since about the mid-1990s. And so, it's not as if SWAT teams are out patrolling streets or that they're being used primarily to apprehend, you know, murderers and rapists and burglars, although there was some of that in the early 90s. But, the SWAT, the militarization trend really accelerated in the early 1980s. That we didn't really see the drop in crime start until about the mid-1990s. So the timelines don't really line up. And again, I think the way that these tactics are used don't really suggest that they're being used to target the kind of crime that's actually dropped.
Back to the phones. Carl is with us in Layton, Utah. Carl, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I've just unfortunately just tuned in, but I've never heard a more blatant distortion of facts in my life. I've been a police officer for 29 years. Been on two separate SWAT teams on different agencies. And as far as the militarization and cooperating with the military, in all my time in police, I have never associated with military and had any training from them in SWAT. Yes, there are tactics that are used by SWAT teams that mimic police or mimic military tactics. But the reason that SWAT teams have been used, if you go back and look at statistics as far as number of cop deaths, that's when SWAT became popular, was trying to minimize those SWAT deaths. And having been in on, I don't know how many entries as a SWAT member, the reason SWAT is used is to protect people, not just the officers, but the people that the warrants are being served on. By using the SWAT tactics, the number of people who are being injured, and I'm talking about the suspects that are being injured and killed, has dropped dramatically since the years of SWAT teams. And further, SWAT teams are not used investigatively. They're used by investigative units who have used a matrix. There's an actual matrix which includes about 30 different items, and you have to reach a certain point scale before SWAT can be used and before SWAT is used. And all of those items on the SWAT matrix are used to determine, is the SWAT team necessary and what are the dangers? Because anytime you get in a shootout, no matter what the situation with police officer, both the bad guy and the cops have a tendency to miss at times. That's a product of being put under stress in a shooting situation, which is a very fine motor skilled art. And when you put stress into the equation, bullets tend to fly wildly, and they have a tendency to hit other houses where innocent people are. So by using SWAT teams, which minimize that, and by tactic, put the bad guy at a disadvantage, it makes everybody so much safer. And the facts and the terms that this individual is using to, you know, get his point across is such a distortion. It's atrocious.
Well, let me ask you, Carl, because there's a lot to sort of chew on there, and I want to have Bradley Balko respond to. But do you not agree that there's sometimes there have been excessive uses of SWAT teams to break up small stakes poker games, paintball games, frat parties, rave parties? I mean, there are some documented cases that he's using. He's not just sort of making this stuff up. Do you acknowledge that there are times when this gets a bit excessive?
There could be, but at the same time, when you talk about the use of SWAT teams, if you, and having been a member of a small agency, we responded on large parties.
Yeah.
Now, as a small agency, we didn't have the ability, the number of people, to go in and break up this party. And so you called in SWAT teams, people who are trained so that they don't overreact in a situation like that. And they're not dressed up. They're not, you know, they don't have all the gear on.
But Carl,
the actual reports that he's referring to.
Well, read his book. Again, he's not just making it up. And you may be right, but they are documented cases. And I guess the question, because this comes up in the book from time to time, and Bradley Balko, I will let you jump in here for a minute, but I wanted to say, why would you have a SWAT team go to a break up a party? Carl.
Oh,
and then I'll have Bradley talk on that. Why would a SWAT team need to break up a party?
Because you don't have other officers to respond. And you can call out a SWAT team and get maybe 10 or 15 members to go in and break it up when the party has to be broken up. If it's out of control, if the neighbors are complaining, if there's drug use, if you're getting people driving, you know, if it's up the canyon and people are driving down the canyon drunk, the party needs to be broken up. And if you only have three or four officers that are on a shift,
mm-hmm.
where do you get those resources? Do you call everybody, individuals out from home, or do you send out a page to a SWAT team where you can get 10 people in 15, 20 minutes?
Well, Bradley Balko, Carl, thanks very much. Let's take on some of those kinds of things. I think you get an indication there from Carl, this idea that just the basic idea that you need a SWAT team at all to go and break up a party is maybe entirely valid, but it's an interesting point of view. But let's break this down. One of the things he refers to is this idea of safety, and this is something you've debated before. You were on Fox News not so long ago with an Ohio sheriff by the name of Russ Martin. And what Russ Martin says, and what I think Carl is implying here, is that what you're calling militarization is actually specialization, and that these more aggressive tactics are actually keeping police officers safer and suspects safer, is another point that Carl made. So talk about that safety part first.
Right. Well, I would argue that when you're breaking into someone's home early in the morning or at night while they're sleeping with armed men breaking into the home, you're listening to a very primal response in people, a very, you know, fight or flight type response. And if you're in your own home, of course, flight isn't really an option. And, you know, I interviewed lots and lots of police officers for the book, so this isn't me just sort of opining, you know, on my own lack of law enforcement experience. But it makes things more dangerous because if somebody's asleep in a back room they have a gun in the house for protection, you can't get back there quickly enough before they get the gun out of their nightstand. And this is particularly true of people who, you know, if it's a low-level crime or if you get the wrong house, because those are people who are more likely or are less likely to think that the people in their home would be police because there wouldn't be any reason for that to happen. So, you know, I would argue that this actually, you know, may make things more dangerous. And, you know, if you look at situations where you have an actual fugitive, an actual dangerous person with a violent history that police are trying to apprehend, they typically don't go in the middle of the night with the flash grenades and the SWAT team and the battering ram. They typically, you know, they set up a perimeter and they, you know, try to find a way to get the person to surrender peacefully. I talk in the book about Whitey Bulger, the you know, notorious gangster. This is a guy who had a, you know, a small arsenal and had 19 homicides to his name. And the way they apprehended him when they found him was they found out, they did some research and found out that he rented a storage locker, and they had somebody, a member of the management call and say somebody had broken into a storage locker and they needed him to come down and sign some papers. He shows up and they arrest him, you know, without incident. And, you know, the reason why they can't do that kind of get that creative with these drug raids is that there are just too many of them. And we're, you know, when you're conducting serving eight or 10 drug warrants a week, you just don't have the personnel to come up with those kinds of, you know, solutions that look for a more peaceful, less confrontational approach. And that's, you know, that's really why I argue in the book that the drug war is really what is driving this trend.
Carl, thanks very much. We don't have a lot of time for reforms, but it's an important part of the book, so I want to talk about some of these. You say that the best reform is to scale back the best reform to scale back this type of policing is to end the drug war altogether. Say something about that, if you would. That's important.
Sure. Well, I mean, that's really what's been driving this trend. Of course, you know, that would be the most effective reform, and it's probably the one that's least likely to happen. So we might get into some of the other ones that, you know, could actually happen. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think the one – I mean, it would be great if we could scale back SWAT teams. And, you know, if I could write a law about when the SWAT team should be deployed, it would be, you know, something like when you have someone who is either in the process of committing a violent crime or will commit one imminently without some sort of police intervention. That, I think, is, you know, an appropriate use of SWAT team. Again, when you're using violence to diffuse an already violent situation in order to save lives, you're not serving warrants on people who are still just suspects of crimes. But, you know, more broadly, I think even beyond the SWAT team, you know, we've got to kind of combat this militaristic culture and this very kind of us versus them mentality that has set in, I think, in a lot of police departments. And the police officers and police chiefs that I talk to recommend this idea of community policing.
Right.
And this is really probably the key reform. And I think it's this idea that police officers, you know, today they spend a lot of time in their squad cars. They're really the only interactions they have with communities tend to be when something's wrong or there's some sort of altercation, which is bad for police community relations. But it's also just a bad, you know, day for a police officer. I mean, imagine if your workday, your only interactions with other people were negative. Yeah. You know, it'd be kind of a miserable work experience. But, you know, this idea that cops should be out walking beats and they should know, you know, the names of the principals of the schools where they work and the business leaders, and they should be attending community meetings and neighborhood meetings. And it's this idea that cops should have a stake in the communities that they serve, and they should be seen as a part of those communities. So when it does come time to use force, the community sees them as one of their own, you know, using force to protect them and not this outside entity, you know, that has kind of been imposed upon them. But, you know, part of that is also we just need to get away from this war rhetoric and constant martial rhetoric from politicians. You know, police are not at war with the citizens they serve. They're not at war with drug offenders. There's not, you know, there should not be a war on crime. You know, police should be, we should do everything we can to protect officer safety within the context of, you know, protecting individual rights and preserving these, you know, concepts of a free society like the Castle Doctrine, like the Fourth Amendment. But, you know, we need to see law enforcement as, you know, of keeping the peace, of going back to protecting and serving, not, you know, fighting a war or treating the streets and neighborhoods as battlefields. And, you know, it's not an exaggeration when I say that. I mean, the website Police One wrote a series of responses to my book. And, you know, in one of them, it's a SWAT officer of this small community in Michigan flat out says that he fights a war every day. He sees the streets as a battlefield. You know, he doesn't refer to his beat. He refers to his sector. So you mean I'm not certainly this isn't the case in every community. It certainly isn't every police officer, but you know, it's not an uncommon mentality and it's not an uncommon approach to the job. And I think it's, you know, I think it's getting more common, not less common.
That's Radley Balko. His book is Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces. He joined us from a studio in Nashville. Radley Balko, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.